So what my lab in general is interested in this question, basically how cells monitor things in their environment and then make an appropriate response. And we focus most of our attention on a particular signaling system in a simple eukaryotic system, the budding yeast Saccharomyces cerevisiae. And we've chosen this system because basically because all of the tools required to ask and address interesting questions regarding signaling in single cells and in living cells are available. And there are a lot of ways we can manipulate this system, some of which I'll touch upon today. But so most of our studies focus on budding yeast and on this one signaling pathway that allows cells to monitor levels of a nutrient in the environment. In our case, the nutrient is inorganic phosphate. And then the signaling system allows the cells to detect the presence of the nutrient or lack of the nutrient and then make some appropriate response. What I want to do first is just summarize sort of at a very gross level how the cells respond to limitation for inorganic phosphate. And I will then just frame sort of the two questions I want to try to touch upon today. One of the questions we have, you know, some semblance of an answer that makes sense. And the second question I'll deal with is much more sort of, you'll see, a work in progress and something where I think that input and ideas from people here will, you know, could really help our thinking. Okay, so at any rate, the way essentially all cells, particularly microorganisms, respond to phosphate limitation is diagrammed schematically here. So here I've shown schematically some cell. And basically, in response to phosphate limitation, the cells have three different classes of response. And they all make a great deal of sense. First, the cells increase phosphate uptake across the plasma membrane. And I'll talk a bit about how this happens. Second, the cells have a remarkable ability to store phosphate internally. And in the case of yeast, it's stored in this organelle called the vacuole. The details don't matter. And the form in which it's stored is called polyphosphate, long polymers of inorganic phosphate. So the second thing the cells do is demobilize internal stores. And third, the cells secrete proteins, these phosphatases, outside the cell. And what these phosphatases do is just allow the cell to scavenge phosphate from the environment. So the cells can only uptake, it turns out, inorganic phosphate, not like, you know, they don't readily uptake, for example, ATP or other phosphate sources. So these phosphatases just allow the cell to scavenge inorganic phosphate off of organic dead matter in their environment, basically, and then they uptake this inorganic phosphate using plasma membrane transporters. Okay, so these are sort of the three major responses to phosphate starvation. And I'll tell you now that, like many signaling pathways, most of these responses occur at the level of transcription initiation. And so, as you'll see, a lot of our effort is focused on understanding the program of gene expression induced in response to limitation for inorganic phosphate, and in understanding sort of how these responses are coordinated. And I should mention, I guess, one more thing about the physiology here, in that, and we were talking a bit about this last night, that inorganic phosphate is limiting in the biosphere. It's limiting for microbial growth. And so it's very likely that the cells in their sort of natural environment spend much of their time limited or partially limited. Their growth is at least partially limited by the lack of inorganic phosphate. Okay, so this is sort of the response to complete phosphate starvation. And what the first thing I'm going to talk about today is what happens not in the absence of so we know a lot about what happens in the sort of the complete starvation response, and a lot about how cells behave in the presence of sort of saturating amounts of inorganic phosphate in the media. So amounts in the media that are not at all limiting for growth. And what we've recently, it's taken us quite a bit of time, but what we've recently begun to investigate is how cells respond to phosphate concentrations that lie between these two extremes. And it turns out there, I mean, not surprisingly, there's some very interesting behavior. And I should say that these concentrations, and I'll talk more about this, which here I just term low, are probably a more accurate reflection of, you know, the physiology and the environment normally experienced by the cells. Yeah, so low in terms of actual concentrations. I'll go through this. So in the laboratory, the sort of medium that yeasts normally grow on contain millimolar concentrations of inorganic phosphate. And those concentrations essentially saturate all of the transporters, and so the cells are not limited at all by, not limited for growth by lack of inorganic phosphate. You know, for no phosphate, we literally use the absence of any inorganic phosphate in the medium. And this low range I'm going to talk about spans more than two orders of magnitude in the micromolar range. So from at least one micromolar to 250 micromolar. And what I'm going to tell you is that the response cells have to this low phosphate range, so over a couple orders of magnitude in phosphate concentration, is different from the response they have to the complete absence of phosphate or to the presence of saturating amounts of phosphate. And specifically, it turns out that these two responses occur when cells are partially limited for inorganic phosphate. That is this phosphate uptake and the mobilization of internal phosphate stores. But all of these secreted phosphatases, I'll show you, are not produced.
But normally they won't store much in the
background. Okay, yeah, so normally if they're growing in high phosphate, they fill up the vacuole. The vacuole is essentially full. And in fact, the way to get the vacuole, the way to get them to accumulate the most amount of polyphosphate is to starve them and then feed them high, you know, 10 millimolar inorganic phosphate, and they'll rapidly uptake and fill the vacuole with that.
How much can they store?
So in terms of the number I know is in terms of the percentage of dry weight of the yeast, and it's something on the order of 10% or something. Yeah. 10% chains of inorganic polyphosphate. So there's huge amounts stored here. And it's quite easy to measure. And of course, Arthur Kornberg is something he's sort of pioneered and spent a lot of his recent time studying. Sort of the enzymes involved. There's a lot known, and I won't talk much about this, about the enzymes involved in manufacturing polyphosphate, and then, of course, in mobilizing it from the vacuole. There's a whole thing I won't talk about. Okay, so the two questions, like I said, I want to deal with today are, first, this issue of how cells use this, what I'll tell you is one signaling pathway and one transcription factor to make these different responses to different phosphate levels outside the cell. Okay, so how in this system are thresholds generated that create what are essentially three more or less stable responses? The high phosphate response, this low phosphate or intermediate phosphate response, and the starvation response. Yeah?
Really stupid question.
No, please.
I'm missing something very
important. Okay.
The three responses depend only on the external level of phosphate. It has nothing to do with where it's stored or not inside. I mean,
Okay, so no, you're not missing anything. You're not missing anything. So this is a very good question, and it really gets at this second issue here: how are phosphate levels sensed? And I'll just tell you the answer now, and then I'll explain what I'm talking about in the second, hopefully in the second part of the talk. So experimentally in the lab, of course, what we can manipulate readily is the external phosphate concentration. What the cells care about, as your intuition is alluding to, they care about internal levels. Yes. And I will tell you what evidence we have that they care about internal levels and sort of how we think the circuitry works here that allows the cells to monitor levels and then make an appropriate response. Yes, but internal. Okay, so these are the two things I want to touch upon. And as I mentioned, this first thing here, how the cells make the different responses, is sort of a very mechanistic story where we have some idea of the answer. Certainly we don't know the whole answer, but we know quite a bit. And the second issue here, we don't know very much. We've sort of gleaned some things, and we have some ideas about how things might work, and I'll tell you what the evidence is and what kind of things we can measure and what questions we're interested in, and any suggestions I'd welcome, but particularly this second area. Okay, so first, how the cells make these different responses and generate thresholds. Okay, so first, to answer this, or to tell you what we know about this area, I need to just give you a little bit of background about the molecules. And I should step back and say, I'm only going to tell you about sort of proteins that are essential to understand this story I have. The pathway is, of course, much more complex than I'm going to allude to. I also am not going to show you a whole bunch of experimental data, lest we get hung up on the details of the experiments, because I'm more interested in the concepts here and, rather than showing you, microarray data. I'll give you a flavor of some of the data, but not bog you down with too much data. You may still feel bogged down at the end, but I'll do my best. Okay, so in terms of molecules, the first molecules you need to know about are the ones on this slide. So the story, most of what I'll talk about in the first part of the talk revolves around two sets of molecules shown here. First, this complex of two proteins called FO80 and FO85. These two proteins form an active protein kinase complex. They're a member of this cyclin CDK family of protein kinase, which control cell cycle progression in eukaryotic cells. That detail doesn't matter. The only important point is that these two proteins form an active protein kinase, meaning they covalently modify proteins, using ATP as a substrate, and here I've sort of schematized that. So the substrate for this protein kinase is another protein, unfortunately, called FO4. And this protein is a transcription factor, and it controls the program of phosphate-responsive gene expression. Okay, all the responses I showed you on the previous slides. So part of the way in which things work are when cells are grown in phosphate-rich medium, this protein kinase is active, and it phosphorylates. It finds this transcription factor and phosphorylates it. And phosphorylation of this transcription factor inactivates the protein. I'm going to tell you how it inactivates the protein because it's very important for the sort of first story I'm going to tell you. And if FO4, the transcription factor, is inactive, of course, the phosphate-responsive genes are not turned on. And this is what you want to happen in high phosphate. Yeah?
Is this kinase complex specific to FO4?
Okay, so yeah, that's an interesting issue. So how many substrates are there for this protein kinase? We only know of one other substrate for FO80, FO85. And I'll also tell you the sort of answer to, I guess, the opposite question is, as far as we know, there's only one protein kinase that modifies this transcription factor, FO4. And that is this one I'm telling you about, FO80, FO85. So this kinase is interesting because it turns out that its activity is regulated in response to extracellular concentrations of inorganic phosphate. So it's active when cells are grown in phosphate-rich medium, and it's inactivated by, when cells are starved for phosphate. And I'm not going to talk much about how. We know a little bit about this, but the details don't matter. The important point is that its activity is regulated in response to extracellular concentrations of inorganic phosphate. And so when cells are starved for phosphate, the kinase is inactive, and this transcription factor is not phosphorylated. So the factor is active, and it turns on the program of phosphate-responsive gene expression. We know all of the genes induced in response to phosphate starvation from microarray experiments, first done in Pat Brown's lab, and now my lab has done a huge number of these experiments.
How many are
there? Microarray experiments?
So how many genes are there?
Oh, yeah, okay, that's a good point. So about primary targets of this transcription factor, about 20 to 30 genes that are induced, I should say, more than 2 to 3-fold. Okay, so who's, yeah. And it depends on how you define the cutoff here, but. Okay, so there's one other factor, and I'm going to tell you about that. That factor is not regulated by this signaling pathway, but it does play an important role in the activation of the genes. This is the sort of major trigger, and in fact, it is sufficient. Activation of this factor is sufficient to cause induction of the entire program of phosphate-responsive gene expression. Okay, and I'll tell you about that second factor in two slides. Okay, so this is the basic scheme of things, a kinase whose activity is regulated by this external stimulus, and it regulates this one transcription factor through phosphorylation. Okay, so here I'm going to tell you some details about how this factor is regulated, because the details are critical for understanding how these thresholds are generated. And okay, so the way in which phosphorylation controls the activity of this protein is through two different mechanisms. Okay, so the first thing is that phosphorylation of the transcription factor FO4 controls its localization within the cell. So what I've diagrammed here is a schematic of a cell, any cell, where the big circle, the boundary delimits the plasma membrane, and this little circle represents the nucleus. Okay, and the green here just represents the way in which we visualize the localization of a protein within the cell. In this case, it's this protein FO4, the transcription factor, and what we do is make a protein fusion with the green fluorescent protein. I'm sure many of you know about this. It's very common method, and then we monitor fluorescence using a fluorescence microscope, and we can detect where in the cell the protein's localized. Okay, so what I've diagrammed here is that in high phosphate conditions, when the kinase is active, the transcription factor FO4, it turns out, is localized to the cytoplasm. Okay, so it can't activate gene expression because it's not where the DNA is. So, and this makes a lot of sense. And conversely, when cells are starved for phosphate and FO4, the transcription factor, is not phosphorylated, it's localized to the nucleus, and it has to be in order to activate gene expression. So one would think this is sufficient, you know, to explain all of our observations. But it turns out there's another way in which the transcription factor is regulated that's also phosphorylation dependent. And the other way in which it's regulated is, well, by control of its activity within the nuclear compartment, phosphorylation of FO4 regulates its association with another transcription factor called FO2. So this is the other transcription factor important for expression of phosphate-responsive genes. And I'll tell you, by microarray experiments, essentially all of the phosphate-responsive genes require this other factor, FO2. For their induction. Okay, and so all phosphorylation does is, it's really simple. So FO2 and FO4, they can interact with one another, and as a consequence, they bind to DNA, so this line I schematize is DNA, specifically the promoter region, the regulatory region. These two proteins bind cooperatively to the promoter. Yeah? Yeah, so I'm gonna tell you about that. There, We have all kinds of tricks for controlling the localization of FOFOR, and the tricks derive from really from our understanding of the mechanism by which this process is controlled. I'm going to tell you that on the next slide.
On the top part,
yep.
This caricature represents how much change in by what factor of the level
is. Oh, okay. This thing, well, yeah, roughly. I'll tell you, more than 90, I would say, in the two extremes here, so high phosphate, no phosphate. 95% of the fluorescent signal is localized to the nuclear compartment when FOFOR in this state, in the starvation state, and 95% is localized to the cytoplasm in the high phosphate state. So I don't. No, it's not right because this is 100 and zero the way I made this diagram. It's not quantitatively. It's not accurate. No, it's not a vector of two. Yeah. Yes, FO2 is constitutively localized to the nucleus, so independent of phosphate levels, absolutely. And so, I didn't get to this, but the bottom line is that the two proteins, FO2 and FO4, they have some affinity for one another when FO4 is unphosphorylated, and when FO4 is phosphorylated, the phosphorylation, you know, decreases the binding energy between these two proteins, and so as a consequence, it affects the cooperative binding of these two proteins to DNA. Specifically, I should step back and say, so most of our studies have focused on one phosphate responsive gene. It's not just historical reasons, it's sort of technical or experimental reasons. This gene called FO5. And so that's why I show you, I'm diagramming here what's happening at the FO5 promoter. So we know this experimentally. We know that FO2 and FO4, we know where they bind in the promoter region, we know the two proteins bind cooperatively, and we know that phosphorylation of FO4 affects the interaction between the two proteins. Okay, so two different mechanisms by which phosphorylation controls the subcellular, controls the activity of FO4. And in a minute we're going to talk about, I mean, something we didn't understand for a long time, and now we think we have some understanding of, I mean, why you have two different mechanisms. I mean, do they function redundantly? If so, why have two? What's the point of this? Okay, so before that, I need to tell you a little bit about how, and I won't tell you everything we know, but just what you need to know, how phosphorylation of this one protein controls these two different properties. Yeah, sure. I want you to understand.
So how is one not implied by two? I'm saying if the way I sort of see it is, okay, it's not phosphorylated, it gets sequestered in the nucleus because the other guy is holding on to him. No, okay, you understand?
No,
the other way.
Yeah, so...
Oh,
so
because no, all I'm saying is it seems to be like it's not a different mechanism, it's a consequence of the first. That's what I was saying. Okay.
Yeah, it's not, and but you bring up an interesting point. So for example, when FO4 is phosphorylated, well, I sort of see what you're alluding to. When FO4 is phosphorylated, it doesn't efficiently interact with FO2.
So it's like one is just a consequence of what two is doing, you know, but it's not a different mechanism.
It is a different mechanism. Yeah, I mean, some of this is semantics, but...
Well, yeah, it would be all over the place equally. But you're observing more than that. That's
yes, and I'll tell you that this regulation is independent of FO2. I mean, the mechanisms can be separated. And I'll tell you mechanistically, I'll show you on the next slide, they're separate. Okay, so how does phosphorylation control these two things? Well, it turns out that FO4 is the transcription factor, which I've schematized here as a line, N meaning N terminus, C terminus. It has four sites of phosphorylation, okay, which are, I've labeled here as, you know, SP 2, 3, 4, and 6, where SP just denotes serine proline, the two amino acids that are recognized by the protein kinase. Don't worry about it. It's minutia, but it's the way I'll refer to the sites because we have to have some language to talk about the sites. And the reason they're numbered 2, 3, 4, and 6 instead of 1, 2, 3, and 4 is has to do with the way we figured out the function of these sites and their identity. Don't worry about it. So 2, 3, 4, and 6, that's the way I'm going to talk about them. All four, so the serine here is what's modified. It's the residue that has the hydroxyl that gets phosphorylated. And all of the modifications, as I mentioned before, are put on by that one protein kinase, FO80, FO85, whose activity is regulated in response to extracellular phosphate levels.
From some particular order?
Oh, that's a good, I'm getting there. That's a good question. Yes, is the answer. Yes. And you'll see it's critical for generating the different responses. Okay, so so it turns out the way in which phosphorylation of this protein controls the two properties I described on the previous slide, I think is quite elegant. In the sense that it turns out, so phosphorylation, the roles of these phosphorylation sites, I'll tell you up front, can be separated. They play separate and distinct roles in controlling the activity of this transcription factor. And what I mean by that is, for example, the way in which the subcellular localization of this protein, FO4, is controlled is by controlling its import into the nuclear compartment, as well as its export from the nuclear compartment. And we know a great deal about this. I'm going to spare you the details, but there are a whole bunch of molecules involved in carrying this transcription factor and other nuclear proteins into the nuclear compartment and other proteins that are involved in carrying them out of the nuclear compartment. Okay? Nuclear transport's energy dependent, and I can tell you more about that if people are interested at some point, but the details aren't relevant for what I'm going to talk about. The only thing you need to know is that when these two sites are phosphorylated, sites 2 and 3 on FO4, so when these two amino acids are phosphorylated, it is recognized by a protein that carries it out of the nucleus. And so I'll tell you, experimentally, phosphorylation of sites 2 and 3 is necessary and sufficient to promote export of FO4 from the nucleus. Okay, similarly, phosphorylation of this one residue, this serine I'll call SP4, is necessary and sufficient to inhibit import of FO4 into the nucleus. And the way this works is when this residue is phosphorylated, this protein that is required to carry FO4 into the nucleus, it just can't bind FO4 as well. So in an import, if FO4 is inhibited. Okay, so the bottom line is that phosphorylation of these three sites, 2, 3, and 4, conspire to keep FO4 localized to the cytoplasm in these high phosphate conditions. Okay, so finally, phosphorylation of this one site, site 6, is necessary and sufficient to regulate the interaction with this other transcription factor called FO2. Okay, and as I said, I mean, really, these modes of regulating FO4 are completely separable, meaning we can prevent, say, this mode of regulation, the regulation of FO4 export, by making mutations in these phosphorylatable residues. We change them to residues that can't be phosphorylated. Okay, so now the only way to regulate FO4 is by, you know, inhibiting import and inhibiting FO2 interaction. Then we can examine the consequences, and we can do this in all kinds of permutations. So we know experimentally that this is true.
Can I just ask a question?
Sure. There's not, okay, that, okay, experiment.
That would explain why you need the other men. There was a little bit there.
Zero FO4 in the nucleus. No, actually, I would say no. In fact, yes, the only reason I say there is a little, so this is very hard for us to measure accurately. So below sort of, This is a sort of technical problem with our ability to measure by fluorescence microscopy. And I should say, we haven't really pushed the limit with the state of... We're using GFP, absolutely. And in a big volume, even as large as the nucleus, we can't. But I will tell you, the reason I answered your question yes is that there, for example, by in vivo footprinting, the details don't matter. There are ways to tell whether FO4 is bound to certain sites within the genome. And I'll tell you, in high phosphate, there are promoters to which FO4 is still bound. Okay, so there must be molecules in the nucleus.
And that's why you probably need the other mechanism.
Yeah. You also, yes, yes. There are a lot of ways to rationalize the other mechanism. And I'll give you one idea. But yes, yours is also a reasonable idea. Okay, so it turns out that these mechanisms, so the two mechanisms I referred to earlier for controlling FOFOR activity are, first, you know, regulation of its subcellular localization, so I'm lumping together export and import, and second, control of its activity in the nucleus by controlling the interaction with FO2. Oh, yep. Okay, so I'll tell you, FO4 interacts, there's nothing we know that interacts with RNA polymerase, although there are lots of ways to activate, to stimulate transcription initiation. And the only thing that's really known from about that with respect to this particular system comes from work from a different lab that's shown that FO4, the activation domain, the part that's important not for binding DNA, but stimulating transcription initiation, that part interacts with a part of the basal transcriptional machinery called TF2B. It's just one of the many factors involved in transcription initiation. Whether that is the sort of rate limiting or important step for activation, it's not known. The activation domain is absolutely required for inducing transcription. But this promoter, and this is something else my lab works on, the activation domain is also required for reorganizing chromatin structure, nucleosomes. And that step is required prior to transcription initiation. So if that's blocked, it doesn't matter what's going on with initiation.
And
yeah.
It's a simultaneous phosphorylation of both those.
Okay. Yeah, So I'll tell you a little bit about the timing of phosphorylation of the different sites. As far as we know, interdependence, as far as we know, no interdependence, meaning you can imagine, we make mutations in these sites and then monitor the kinetics with which the other sites get phosphorylated, and there's no interdependence. Oh, absolutely. Oh, one of these two? No. Okay, that's both of these are required for export. And the way in which that works, why two phosphorylation events are required for interaction with this other protein, we don't know. But I'll tell you, it's nothing simple, meaning you can't recapitulate it with a peptide that corresponds to these residues phosphorylated plus some flanking sequence. There's something required about the structure, three-dimensional structure of the protein. A very large portion of the protein is required to be recognized by the export receptor. Okay. Okay, so... No, the only structure that's known is this C-terminal bit, which I haven't labeled here, that corresponds to the DNA binding domain. X-ray structure has been solved bound to DNA. It's not particularly illuminating for what I'm going to tell you about. The rest of it is totally unknown. Okay, so the final point I want to make about this is... that these two mechanisms for controlling FO4 activity, that is the control of the subcellular localization and control of the FO2 interaction, they act partially redundantly to control transcription of this reporter gene that I've told you about called FO5. What I mean by that is if you stick FO4 in the nucleus by mutating these phosphorylation sites, say 2, 3, and 4. So now the protein's stuck in the nucleus. It cannot be exported. It's stuck there. If site 6 is phosphorylated, FO5 is not turned on. Okay? And conversely, if site 6 is mutated, one still gets appropriate, more or less appropriate regulation of transcription of this gene FO5 by control of the subcellular localization of FO4. Yep. No, well, depend on, what do you mean depend on concentration? I mean...
If you have lots of these, then what are you going to
have? Lots of these. What's these?
Lots of
molecules? Yeah. Well, the amount of FO4, if you overexpress FO4, sure, Sure, you can bypass a lot of, not a lot, you can bypass some aspects of the regulation. What I'm talking about does not involve perturbations of the protein levels of FO4. No perturbation. Just the normal amount of protein.
Do you have a bypass, you have the concentration?
So in the nucleus, for example, when FO4 is completely nuclear, completely meaning, 95%, it's on the order of very low micromolar, 1 to 3 micromolar. Yeah.
What was the converse you think that you said? Could you say it again?
I forget what I said.
If you disable 2, 3, and 4, then something happens.
Okay, if you disable 2, 3, and 4.
Okay, what was the other thing?
If you disable 6.
Right. So if you disable the possibility of
controlling the FO2 interaction, now, when sites 2, 3, and 4 are phosphorylated, FO5, that's the reporter gene, it's turned off. And when sites 2, 3, and 4 are unphosphorylated, it's turned on. And that makes sense, right? Okay, but the only point I want to make is that there are these two mechanisms for regulating FO4. I'm claiming they're two mechanisms. And I'm telling you they're partially redundant in the sense that either one, is enough to regulate FO4 activity. Okay.
And the level of regulation is half the expression of FO5 or down by
more than a factor of 100.
So,
yeah.
So I guess the only thing I just wanted to understand was the question was, so the presumably the reason that the reporter gene is inhibited is not produced is when the only way that happens is when 2 and 4 bind, right?
When two and four
do not, and the phosphorylation of SP6 is the only thing that prevents it from binding. Is that correct?
Well, the other thing that can prevent it from binding is if it is not in the nucleus.
Of course.
Oh, okay. Okay, yes, yes, yes.
That's the only mechanism.
Yeah, as far as we know, yes. You got it. Yeah. Oh, my God. We're never going to finish.
Just a couple hundred fold increase?
Yeah, 1 to 2.
mRNA.
Yeah, protein's about the same. I'll tell you, in this system, little or no, I'm going to tell you only about one instance of post-transcriptional or post-translational regulation. I'll tell you about it. Everything else, as far as we know, it's regulated at the level of transcription initiation.
In the situation where you separate the two mechanisms by an activator or an activator, and you quantitatively the difference between 0 phosphate and 9 phosphate, you see smaller fold increases?
Yes, absolutely. And the reason for that is not that we've perturbed the absolute magnitude of induction, but rather that there's leaky expression when we abolish. And that's why I say partially redundant, okay? But again, that's interesting, but doesn't matter for what I'm going to tell. I mean, it's important, but it doesn't matter for what I'm going to tell you. Okay. No, okay, I'm not going to tell you about that. What I want to tell you about, this is a good opportunity. We keep getting sidetracked to remind you what I want to tell you. There's the no phosphate response, right? All those three responses I told you about. Details don't matter. And then there's this low phosphate or intermediate phosphate response that is different. It is not the same as the no phosphate response, nor is it the same as the high phosphate response. And what I want to tell you is how you use this one signaling pathway, one protein kinase, one transcription factor to generate three different responses, so two thresholds. How? Okay. That's what we want to explain. Okay, so I told you that. Okay, so I've told you that these mechanisms act partially redundantly to regulate this gene FO5. And we started to wonder, why have these multiple mechanisms? And what's the point of this? Like, what's the matter in terms of the physiology? And the way we started to unravel at least part of the answer is by asking the simple question, I told you there are 20 to 30 genes that are induced in response to phosphate starvation. They're phosphate responsive genes, all of them regulated by this transcription factor FO4. And we started to wonder, do these two mechanisms for controlling FO4 activity, do they act partially redundantly to control transcription of all of the phosphate responsive genes. So do all those genes behave just like Fo5, or do different genes behave differently in terms of their sensitivity to these mechanisms for regulating Fo4? And it, you know, if you had asked me back then, I would have said, oh, all the genes are going to behave the same. But I'll tell you, that's not the answer. And we understand something about why that is. Okay. Oh, yeah. I wanted to save that for later.
Oh, okay.
Yes, I'm going to get back to the physiology. I want you to understand the mechanism first, and then I'll rationalize in terms of the physiology. Okay. Actually, I'll get to that very soon. Okay, so the experiment we did to ask, well, what we wanted to know is, are all of the phosphate responsive genes regulated like Fo5? Namely, is phosphorylation of site 6 sufficient to inactivate Fo4's ability to turn on transcription of all phosphate responsive genes? I told you when site 6 is phosphorylated, it can't efficiently turn on Fo5. But what about the other 20 to 30 genes? Can it turn on any of them? And so the way in which we address this question is by using mutants. So I'm not going to show you the data, but I'm going to tell you a little bit about how we did the experiment so it doesn't seem like hocus pocus. And also to so you have some sense of like sort of what tools we have here. So schematically, I've told you that when the kinase Fo80, Fo85 is fully active, Fo4 is phosphorylated, and I'll represent it schematically like this, where the phosphorylation sites are labeled, and the blue balls just mean they're phosphorylated. And in when the kinase is inactive, Fo4 is unphosphorylated, so no balls and sticks present, and it's localized to the nucleus. Okay, so what we did is to make two mutants that differ only in their ability to be phosphorylated on site 6. Both of them are stuck in the nucleus. So it's not interesting. If Fo4 is in the cytoplasm, of course it can't turn on gene expression. So we have to remove the localization regulation and stick it in the nucleus. And the way we do this is by mutating the phosphorylation sites that control the subcellular localization. So when we mutate the phosphorylation sites from serine to alanine, those sites 2, 3, and 4 that control localization, I'll tell you, Fo4 is stuck in the nucleus. Okay? And in this mutant here, which mimics the sort of no phosphate state of the normal Fo4, we mutate site 6 as well. Again, we make a substitution that prevents phosphorylation of site 6. So this molecule, which we call SA1-4PA6, the only thing that's important about it is it looks just like unphosphorylated Fo4. Okay? So that's one mutant we made, and the second mutant we made differed in only one amino acid. Okay? And that is, this site 6 here could be phosphorylated. So this mutant does not have this PA6 substitution that blocks phosphorylation of site 6. And so the way schematically this mutant looks is it, you know, has this ball and stick that represents phosphorylation of site 6. This, both of these mutants, as I've told you, they can't be exported from the nucleus, and their import can't be inhibited, so they're stuck in the nucleus. Okay, they don't move out of the nucleus at all. So as soon as the molecule is made in the cytoplasm, it's translated, it's imported into the nucleus, and it's stuck there. This SA1-4 wild type 6, when cells are grown in high phosphate, we know is phosphorylated on site 6, and the other mutant is not phosphorylated on site 6. So that's the game. And what we did, so we want to know, well, is this mutant that can be phosphorylated only on site 6, can it turn on expression of any of the phosphate responsive genes? I've told you it can't turn on this gene Fo5. And so what we did is to make yeast strains carrying these two Fo4 mutants, and we used microarray analysis, which I'm not going to show you, to characterize the programs of gene expression induced by each of these mutants. So we know all the genes induced, and we can do all kinds of comparisons. And I'm going to summarize for you on the next slide, give you the take-home message. So first, this mutant, SA1-4PA6, this thing can't be phosphorylated. I told you it looks just like unphosphorylated Fo4. And indeed, when you compare the program of gene expression induced, and I've shown you the sort of class of what I'm going to call highly induced phosphate responsive genes, When we compare the pattern of gene expression induced by this FO4 mutant grown in high phosphate to the pattern induced by FO4 when cells are starved for phosphate, the patterns are highly similar. Okay, not indistinguishable, but very similar. So the same genes are induced, and there's some quantitative differences between several of the genes, but I'll tell you, all of these genes are induced. And so what I'm going to tell you about now is what happens with this other mutant that can be phosphorylated on site 6. And I'm going to refer to the degree of expression or induction in this mutant that's phosphorylated on site 6. I'm going to reference to this SA1 to 4 PA6 where the expression we'll call 100%. And what we see is that there are two classes of genes. Okay, there's a bunch of the genes that are induced to greater than 65% of their maximal level of expression. So they're highly induced. Some of them induced, I mean, much more than 65%. For example, this gene FO84 that I'm going to talk about is induced to near maximal levels. Additionally, so there's another class. Things really split into two groups. And this second class of genes shown on the right is induced, not induced very much. In fact, all of them are induced to less than 20% of their maximal level of induction. And the genes in pink or purple here are induced to less than 5 to 10% of their maximal level of induction. So the take-home point I want you to get is that this mutant that's can be regulated only in this by control of its interaction with this transcription factor FO2. It's stuck in the nucleus. It can efficiently activate transcription of a whole bunch of phosphate responsive genes. And these other genes I've told you about, which of course include the reporter gene FO5 I was talking about previously, these genes are not efficiently induced. And in fact, most of them are really virtually not induced, less than 5 to 10% of their maximal level. Yep. Yes, yes. And I'll talk a little bit about that. Yep. Yes, all of these genes, so this entire signal is dependent on the presence of FO2. Yes. All of them, absolutely. Okay, and the color coding here, the final point I want to make about this is that things, the genes break down. If we ask what's known about the function of these genes, they break into clearly defined responses or categories. So the genes shown in pink or purple here are involved primarily in they're the secreted phosphatases that are sent out into the extracellular space. And the genes shown in orange or red here are all involved in either phosphate transport, phosphate uptake, or mobilization of internal stores. Okay, so there's a clear sort of functional division in terms of the program of gene expression induced. So when this site is phosphorylated, you get induction not of the phosphatases, but of the other response. Okay, but so this is FO4 mutants. Why were we interested in this? And we're going to get back to the physiology, but first I need to tell you one other thing that I've sort of alluded to regarding this site, site 6. And the other piece of information you need to know comes from in vitro studies of phosphorylation of FO4. So we carried out a series of detailed kinetic studies to characterize the mechanism. So in a purified system, purified proteins, no cells, no other protein present, we characterized how this kinase FO80, FO85 phosphorylates FO4. And what I mean by how is, you know, measuring kinetic constants and such, and we used some computer modeling to gain insight into the reaction because things are kind of complicated, right? There are multiple sites of phosphorylation, and so there are sort of multiple paths that the molecule can take going from unphosphorylated to fully phosphorylated FO4 in terms of the order of phosphorylation of the sites, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to dwell on any of that, but there are two points I want to summarize from these studies. So the first is that the reaction, the phosphorylation reaction, is partially distributed. So what I mean by this is I've summarized here, on average, For each productive collision between the kinase and the substrate, Fo4, there are two phosphates transferred to Fo4. Now, the reason this is important, right, is the sort of the two extremes here are just what people refer to as distributive, fully distributive, and fully processive. Fully processive means that for each interaction between the kinase and substrate, all of the phosphates would be transferred in one interaction, one binding event, one collision, one productive collision. Distributive would mean that it would require, in this case, four productive collisions in order to get fully phosphorylated Fo4. The reason this is important is if the reaction were fully processive, there would never be an opportunity to accumulate partially phosphorylated intermediates of Fo4. And I'm going to tell you, partially phosphorylated intermediates of Fo4 accumulate, and that these isoforms or phosphoforms have activity that is different from the unphosphorylated and from the fully phosphorylated form of the molecule. Okay? Yep.
So the two events could be, for instance, 2 and 6.
Yes, they could be. That's right. That's right. That's right. So the reaction's partially distributive, and even more interesting, it turns out the kinase, as I alluded to, has site preference. And what I mean by this is that statistically, so it has a preference for phosphorylation of site 6, and it turns out that it phosphorylates site 6 before sites 2 and 3, so 2 and 3 control export 90% of the time.
When you say 2 and 3, you mean?
Yes, and the reason I'm giving you this comparison is because these are the sites whose phosphorylation is required to get Fo4 localized to the cytoplasm. And what we care about in terms of partially phosphorylated intermediates, we care about intermediates localized to the nucleus because that's the only place Fo4 has any activity, and we care about this intermediate that's phosphorylated on site 6.
So the probability of phosphorylating each site is exactly the same.
Yep. Yep. It phosphorylates 6 in terms of, like, if you look at Fo4 phosphorylated one time, you look at the distribution of Fo4 molecules phosphorylated one time, which that's the experiment we did. Isolate Fo4 phosphorylated once and ask which sites phosphorylated, and then count up the number of molecules in that are phosphorylated on each site. What we see is about 65% of the molecules are phosphorylated on site 6. Oh, that's a good question. Yeah. So the kinase, so he wants to know, is the kinase localized to the cytoplasm or the nucleus? It turns out the kinase is localized exclusively to the nucleus. Okay? And I'll tell you, the phosphatase that dephosphorylates Fo4 is localized to the cytoplasm. And we think, I'm not going to talk about this, but this is something interesting to discuss. We think the compartmentalization is likely critical for the dynamics and the behavior of the system here.
And the kinase carries 4 phosphates or can
phosphorylate? No, okay, so the kinase doesn't carry 4 phosphates. What happens is the kinase, in order to transfer a phosphate to Fo4, it needs to bind ATP. And after the phosphorylation reaction, it needs to release ADP before it can bind a subsequent molecule of ATP. So you might even ask, well, how the heck does it even get 2 phosphorylation events per binding event? And there's no mystery here. What we have found out is that, you know, Fo4 has those phosphorylation sites. Fo4 has a domain that essentially distinct from the phosphorylation sites that anchors it to the kinase. Okay, and so the distributive nature of the reaction is essentially a balance between the catalytic rate that governs, you know, phosphate transfer, and the off rate for dissociation of Fo4. So KKFK off ratio is what determines this balance. Yeah. Okay. So the reason I'm telling you this, we carried out this study completely separately, and then we were doing this in vivo stuff I was telling you about, and it really, like, the two studies really converged in the sense that this in vitro data here, the partially distributive nature and the site preference, of course, predicts that if the kinase is partially active, that partially phosphorylated forms of FO4 might accumulate. And these partially phosphorylated forms, we predict from in vitro studies, will be localized to the nucleus because a significant portion of the partially phosphorylated intermediates we predict will not be phosphorylated on sites 2 and 3 and will be phosphorylated on site 6. Okay, and the reason we were excited is that this intermediate looks just like the FO4 mutant I told you about, whose gene expression program we characterized, and we showed the mutant can activate some of the phosphate responsive genes and not others. And so, but that's a mutant, and this is like real wild type, you know, physiological FO4. And so we wondered, well, what physiological conditions might lead to accumulation of this partially phosphorylated intermediate? And again, there's no mystery here. We knew the kinase, FO8085, maximally active in high phosphate conditions, minimally active in no phosphate conditions. All we did is titrate phosphate outside the cell, so we maintain experimentally constant extracellular phosphate levels, and then we look for accumulation of this intermediate. And the way we look is using antibodies that recognize exclusively, it's not exclusively, they have a strong preference for recognition of FO4 phosphorylated on, for example, site 2, site 3, and site 6. So we have three different antibodies, each of which recognizes predominantly the phosphorylated form of site 2, the phosphorylated form of site 3, and the phosphorylated form of site 6. And so we use these antibodies. We titrate phosphate, we use the antibodies, and we ask, are there conditions where we get accumulation of this form of FO4? And we do this by Western blotting, you know, separate proteins by SDS page, and then use the antibodies to probe to ask, what's the phosphorylation state of FO4 in these conditions? And the real data is shown here. And I don't think I need to belabor the real data, just tell you the result, which is quite apparent. So here we're probing with the antibodies that recognize phosphorylated forms of site 2, 3, and 6. And then this other antibody that doesn't care what the phosphorylation state of FO4 is. So we can use it as a way to sort of normalize for loading on this gel. Just an experimental point. So in no phosphate, of course, these sites 2, 3, and 6, I kept telling you they're not phosphorylated. And indeed, they're not phosphorylated. And in high phosphate, the sites are fully phosphorylated. We know from other experiments, and here you see bands corresponding to, you know, reactivity with these phospho-specific antibodies. And in intermediate phosphate, what we see is very little detectable reactivity with the antibodies that recognize phosphorylated sites 2 and 3, and significant 50% reactivity with an antibody that recognizes phosphorylated site 6. Okay, so the take-home message here is that under these conditions, I've labeled intermediate, and I'll talk a little bit about this in the next slide. What we see is accumulation of this form of FO4 that's preferentially phosphorylated on site 6 and not on sites 2 and 3. Okay, so what are the conditions, like what's intermediate phosphate, and what are the consequences in terms of gene expression when you accumulate this intermediate? So here, this isn't really that important, but the intermediate, as predicted, is this form of FO4 is localized to the nucleus, and I'll just tell you that this form of FO4 accumulates in when extracellular phosphate concentrations are between about 1 micromolar and 250 micromolar. And you can see here, you know, 100 micromolar phosphate, these are pictures of yeast cells carrying the FO4 green fluorescent protein fusion. So the dots here represent the nuclei. You can see them because FO4 is accumulated in the nucleus. All the way on the right, the FO4 is pretty much evenly distributed throughout the cell. The reason it's not really evenly distributed is these dark spots represent the vacuole where the protein can't get. But at any rate, the quantitation and minutiae here don't matter. The only thing is, you know, you can see something about the threshold here for conversion of FO4 to this nuclear form and the cytoplasmic form. It's somewhere between 100 and 300 micromolar, and I'll tell you it's about 250 micromolar. Now if we look at gene expression induced under these different conditions, here I'm showing you, you know, the phosphate concentrations labeled here. What you see is that, for example, well, no phosphate, we get high induction of both FO5 and another phosphate responsive gene, FO84. This gene, I should mention, So FO5, I've told you about, FO84 falls into the class that can be turned on by the FO4 mutant that's phosphorylated on site 6. And similarly, here with wild-type FO4, so no FO4 mutants grown in these different phosphate concentrations, what you see in the white bars is that in these phosphate concentrations, FO84 can be induced to about 50% of maximal levels. And in contrast, FO5 and the other pink genes I showed you way back, they're not efficiently activated under these intermediate phosphate conditions. And of course, none of the genes are efficiently turned on in these high phosphate conditions.
But FO5 is one of the phosphatases.
Yep. FO5 is one of the phosphatases, right. So Andrew wanted to know about this. It's true. So, and FO84, it turns out, is a high affinity phosphate transporter. And that's going to become important. Okay, so the take-home message is that in intermediate phosphate conditions, this form of FO4 accumulates that's phosphorylated on site 6, not on the other sites, localized to the nucleus. And I'll just tell you, this form, like the FO4 mutant I was talking about previously, it can efficiently activate transcription of the genes shown in the left here, which are predominantly involved in uptake of phosphate across the plasma membrane and also mobilization of internal stores of phosphate. In contrast, it does not efficiently activate transcription of the genes involved in production of the secreted phosphatases. Okay, so why is this interesting? So I'm going to tell you two reasons. First, a much more general thing that I'm sure is better known by a bunch of you than by myself, and that is that there are a very large number of programs of gene expression that are induced in cells, and a very limited number of transcription factors. And so this is always, I mean, this is a sort of constant problem of how, with a limited number of factors, do you generate such complexity in terms of programs of gene expression? And clearly, part of the answer is combinatorial control, meaning, you know, you have factors A and B, and at some promoters AX alone, other promoters BX alone, and other promoters they act together, and you can imagine sort of higher order combinations of factors generating yet more complexity. But this data suggests there's yet another mechanism. So many transcription factors and other regulatory proteins, it turns out, are multiply phosphorylated, just like FO4, and are regulated by this phosphorylation. And a sort of additional mechanism by which complexity in terms of programs of gene expression could be achieved is through the use of this situations where partially phosphorylated forms of factors might accumulate. So that's one general reason why we were interested in this. Okay, so finally, I should say something about how we think why the partially phosphorylated form of FO4 can turn on transcription of this set of genes on the left and not the set of genes on the right. So I've told you that the partially phosphorylated form of FO4 is phosphorylated on site 6. I've told you that site controls interaction with FO2, the other transcription factor. And I've said all of these genes are FO2 dependent. So what's going on? I mean, how is phosphorylation of site 6, why can it turn on this set of genes and not the other? And I will tell you sort of part of the answer comes from another experiment we did where we looked at binding of FO4 in the yeast cell to promoters from each of these classes, from the orange class and from the pink class. And the data can be summarized here, so using representatives from each of the class, FO84 from the class that's activated by FO4 phosphorylated on site 6 and FO5 from the class that's not activated by FO4 phosphorylated on site 6. And what we see is, of course, in terms of binding to DNA in the yeast cell, in no phosphate conditions, we see FO4 is efficiently bound to both the promoters of both the FO84 gene and the FO5 gene. In high phosphate conditions, of course, it's not detectably bound to either promoter. And in intermediate phosphate, what we see is that FO4 is quite efficiently bound to the promoter of FO84. This makes sense because it's turning on transcription of FO84. And it's not bound to FO5. And in some sense, this is what we would expect, because FO5 transcription is not activated, although it need not have been this way. It could have been that phosphorylation, for example, affected activation of transcription rather than affecting DNA binding. Yep? Right, so it turns out that the binding site, that FO2 binds only weakly to DNA, and essentially the affinity is not high enough to get significant occupancy of FO2 in the absence of FO4. So the two proteins bind cooperatively, and so you don't see detectable binding when FO4 is not present. And remember, in high phosphate, FO4 is localized to the cytoplasm and it's phosphorylated on site 6.
Is it
the
differences between the binding sites?
Okay.
Cases, yeah.
Yeah. So I'll tell you. So what do we think's going on? I mean, so this doesn't answer the question, you know, why are these genes activated and not these genes? I've just like pushed the whole thing, the problem back to a problem of binding. I mean, why is FO4 bound here and not here? That's what we think.
These sites are stronger sites and will bind at lower concentration.
These sites, FO84 sites,
yeah,
than the FO5 sites.
Okay.
That's exactly what we think. That's exactly what we think, and that's schematized here. So maybe I shouldn't dwell on this. So this is just a yep. Maybe. Yes. Okay, so, right. So that's why I was cautious in the beginning to say, it's not that phosphorylation abolishes the interaction, of course. I mean, you just get some loss in free energy of binding. When you phosphorylate, the two proteins can't interact as tightly as they would in the absence of phosphorylation. And what we know, I'll tell you, from binding studies is that in this situation, FO2 and FO4 are bound to the FO84 promoter, both of them, and the binding of FO4, which is phosphorylated on site 6, that's schematized by this little ball and stick, that this binding of this partially phosphorylated form of FO4 in fact requires FO2. So this implies strongly, and we have some physical in vitro data, that the two proteins can still interact, albeit with, you know, lower binding energy. And this makes sense, that you might still get occupancy at the FO84 promoter, because of course these interactions are all mutually reinforcing, right? Right. So you're saying, right, so how do we know this ball and stick really exists? Maybe it's just unphosphorylated FO4. Right, and so that, of course, with the wild-type protein is very difficult for us to address, but the only thing that argues against that is the use of the, we've carried out similar binding studies with the FO4 mutants I've talked about. We know that protein, we know that protein is fully phosphorylated on site 6, but you might still argue, oh, well, maybe you can't detect the 0.1% of molecules that aren't phosphorylated, and I'll tell you, we have a mutation that mimics phosphorylation. So where we can do away with all regulation of phosphorylation, we mutate the serine to a negatively charged residue that looks like phosphate to some extent, and we still see the same effect. So there you can't argue sort of the existence of a minor species, because the molecule is essentially homogeneous. But you're absolutely right that in the wild type case, this is very hard for us to deal with experimentally. Yeah, it's a very good point.
Do you see the effects of other residues, 2, 3, and 4, or let's say 2, 3 on the
binding?
No,
does not affect FO2 affinity. Right. So phosphorylation of 2, 3, and 4 don't affect the interaction with FO2. We know that from in vitro studies. I mean, this is all we can do in vitro. Also from in vivo studies, because there are other ways. So I've told you about one way to make FO4 stuck in the nucleus through mutation of the phosphorylation sites that control transport. The other way we can get Fo4 stuck in the nucleus but still phosphorylated on those sites is by making a yeast cell that lacks the protein that carries Fo4 out of the nucleus. And then we can study phosphorylated Fo4 in the nucleus. And everything I said is true. Yeah. Oh. Yes. Yes. Right. Right. So these genes are induced in response to other. Some of them are induced in response to other conditions. We have not examined that carefully. Although we have looked at activation of the signaling pathway by looking at localization, the subcellular localization of this transcription factor, Fo4. And it's very, we have yet to see other conditions that cause robust changes in the localization of Fo4. So gene expression is probably a more sensitive readout. But, so it's not clear at what level those other external stimuli are impinging on this pathway. We haven't done enough studies. We certainly have not focused on that. Yeah, it's a very interesting issue.
But it depends on that increase in expression depends on the presence of Fo4, so the alternative possibility.
Right. We haven't done those studies carefully. And I have not seen a microarray study that has done that. So
but if you just look at all this, the available data that's out there.
Yes. Right, but what he's asking is those studies have not been done in a strain lacking Fo4. He's saying, are they Fo4 dependent? I don't know the answer. As far as I know, those experiments haven't been done. Certainly, they haven't been published, and we have not done them. Yeah, it's very interesting. Just, you know, it's a lot of things to do. Okay, so what was, okay. Okay, so I was summarizing. So what we think is going on. So as was alluded to, all we think is happening is that these two promoters have different affinity for Fo4. That's what we speculate, and we speculate that based on our data and also based on examination of the binding sites in the promoters of the two genes. And then if this is a plausible explanation here, this is just some simulation where we've done some simulation where the difference in modeled the difference in affinity between Fo4 for these two promoters, the Fo5 and the Fo84 promoter, the difference of a factor in somewhere between 10 and 30. I forgot the exact number. And so we model weaker binding to the Fo5 promoter than to the Fo84 promoter. We speculate that phosphorylation of site 6, because it affects the interaction with Fo2, of course, it'll cause the same loss in free energy of binding to both promoters because it's affecting the same step. And what we then think is happening is that in high phosphate, I've told you there's very little Fo4 in the nucleus. In no phosphate, there's significantly more, Fo4 in the nuclear compartment. Here, I think we model a factor of 10 increase in nuclear concentration of Fo4, which certainly agrees with our experimental data. And in this circumstance, we get maximal occupancy or near maximal occupancy of Fo84 in this model, and still significant but not maximal occupancy of Fo5. And then what you see is that in intermediate phosphate, I'll tell you, the concentration of Fo4 in the nucleus is on the order of 85% of the concentration observed in no phosphate. But of course, Fo4 is significantly phosphorylated on site 6. And so what we imagine is happening is here in intermediate phosphate, one still has significant occupancy at the Fo84 promoter, and the reduction in free energy caused by phosphorylation of site 6 affecting the interaction with Fo2 with the Fo5 promoter simply drops occupancy at Fo5 to very low levels, thereby giving very little expression of gene. Yep.
Do you think the Fo2 site on Fo5 and Fo4 is affinity?
Yeah, that's okay. So that's we don't know is the simple answer, and you might wonder why we don't know the answer, and that is because the binding site for Fo2 is very degenerate. It's an AT-rich binding site in the genomes, AT-rich, and they're impossible. Computationally, it's very difficult to pick out those binding sites. And even experimentally, we have trouble with that. So I can't really answer your question. And there's certainly, for the factor you brought up about, you know, differences in FO2 binding sites could certainly influence what's going on. This is simply, you know, our working model, an explanation consistent with all of our observations and something we're trying to test experimentally. But factors such as what you brought up are certainly reasonable. Thanks. And they're hard for us to account for. Okay, so in terms of the physiology and generation of thresholds, I mean, you can guess what I'm going to say. What we think is happening is summarized here. We think that the kinetic properties of this kinase, namely the partially distributive nature of phosphorylation and the preference for phosphorylation of site 6, help generate two different thresholds in this signaling pathway. And I diagram that schematically here. So when phosphate concentrations outside the cell are above about 250 micromolar, we observe essentially no transcription of any phosphate-responsive genes. FO4 is localized to the cytoplasm, but when concentrations drop below 250 micromolar, we first see induction of genes like FO84. FO4 is localized to the nucleus, predominantly phosphorylated on site 6. And then below about 1 micromolar, FO4 is fully unphosphorylated, and all of the phosphate-responsive genes are induced. Okay, and as I mentioned, we think these three states are really generated by the kinetic properties of this kinase. And finally, in terms of the physiology, I've alluded to what we think is happening. So in high phosphate, none of these genes are turned on. FO4 is localized to the cytoplasm, and the cell doesn't need high amounts of the transporter or the phosphatase. In intermediate phosphate, I've told you FO84 and other genes involved in phosphate uptake and internal phosphate mobilization are induced. And in fact, the induction of FO84, the high affinity transporter, causes, of course, more FO84 transporter to be displayed on the plasma membrane. And the phosphate concentrations in intermediate phosphate are equal to or exceed the Km for transport by the FO84 transporter. And so what we speculate is that in intermediate phosphate, if you make more transporter, you uptake more phosphate. Okay, and so we think this allows the cells to make a physiologically appropriate response at this intermediate phosphate concentration, and that they don't have to wait until they experience extreme phosphate starvation and then induce all of the phosphate responsive genes. And I should mention the induction of genes like FO5, this phosphatase, and other phosphatases is energetically expensive. It accounts for about 5% of total cellular protein when it's fully induced. And so we think the cell only does this under sort of extreme conditions of extreme starvation. And of course, the presence of this intermediate phosphate response, another way of looking at this is that this response allows the cells to detect and make an appropriate response at phosphate concentrations that are orders of magnitude above the concentration at which the full response is induced. So here we see this at 250 micromolar happening, and the no phosphate response doesn't occur to below 1 micromolar. And actually, we don't know exactly how much below 1 micromolar, because experimentally this is hard for us to access. Okay, so that is unfortunate, because this is the halfway point. It's too bad, because I would have told you this first if I thought it would take
can
me
you
this.
Give us a short version of it?
Maybe I can give the 10-minute version, not belabor anything. Okay, so maybe the 5-minute version, so people don't get too worn out. So we're really we become very interested in this issue, how phosphate levels are sensed. And I'll tell you right now, we don't know what the sensor is. That is, what molecule it is that's used, whose activity is sensitive to inorganic phosphate or that's used to detect the molecule used as the signal to activate this pathway. We do not know the identity of that molecule. Okay? So what we've had, and it's not for lack of effort, so what we've had to do is to focus on trying to glean from other experiments things about the sensor, you know, without knowing the identity of the molecule. Okay, and so the first thing I want to talk about is sort of there are two different mechanisms you can imagine for detecting or sensing phosphate levels, and this was brought up earlier. One can imagine having an external sensor whose activity or output is a function of external phosphate concentration. Alternatively, one can imagine an internal sensor whose output is a function of the internal intracellular concentration of inorganic phosphate. And of course, these two types of sensors have very different responses and will result in different behavior of the system as a whole. And I sort of here summarized some properties of the two different sensors and a little bit of rationalization of what each type of sensor might be used for. So obviously the external sensor is sensitive to the absolute concentration of ligand or stimulus outside the cell and is essentially, in the simplest scenario, insensitive to the internal concentration of the ligand, if indeed the ligand can be taken into the cell. This type of sensor, if you're measuring something outside, obviously you have the potential to respond quickly to a change in the level of the ligand outside the cell. In contrast, the internal sensor is, of course, in the simplest scenario, insensitive to the absolute concentration of the ligand outside the cell, and sensitive to small changes in the uptake or usage of the ligand, in our case, internal phosphate. Okay, and so in this scenario, with an internal sensor, of course, the rate of uptake of the ligand can have a profound effect on the time scale of the response. And I mean, one sort of generalization is that one might imagine an internal sensor would be good for responding to nutrients because it has properties that are desirable for the response, and that this external sensor might be better for detecting signals like morphogens and growth factors. Okay, so and here I've just diagrammed schematically what we might imagine is going on if the phosphate responsive pathway uses an internal sensor here that's sensitive to the internal concentration of phosphate or some inorganic phosphate or some derivative of it. And in this sort of simple wiring diagram, the internal concentration of the signal would be influenced by usage of internal phosphate, uptake of internal phosphate. And uptake, of course, would be influenced by the amount of transporter that's available to take in inorganic phosphate, and also by the external concentration of phosphate. Okay, and one can write, you know, a set of simple differential equations to model this type of response. And the only point I want to make with this that's probably obvious to all of you is that this internal sensor will be very sensitive to the balance between uptake of, in our case, inorganic phosphate and usage of inorganic phosphate by the cell. Okay, so does the FOAP pathway have an internal sensor? And as I said, all we can do is sort of infer what's going on because we don't know the molecule that's the sensor. So I'm going to tell you two pieces of data that really suggest strongly that sensing is done internally, that the sensor is actually internally. So the first thing is that I should step back and say one way to address this is to ask, well, what's known about other systems? For example, other systems, the way other cells sense and respond to phosphate in the environment. The best known, best studied system is a system in E. coli. And in that case, the transporter itself, a complex of proteins called PSTA, is involved in sensing phosphate. Okay, so it is both the sensor and the transporter. So we naturally asked, well, maybe it's the same.
It's bound to the membrane and then.
Yes. Actually, there's an accessory protein that binds phosphate that's associated with the transporter. Yes. Yes.
But E. coli doesn't store phosphate.
E. coli stores polyphosphate. I'm sure this is known from old literature. Like, calculate the percentage of polyphosphate as a fraction of the total dry volume of the E. coli cell versus the yeast cell. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know. Arthur Kornberg thinks. I mean, it's a major constituent of the cell. I just don't know the comparison to yeast. Yeah. No, that sensor is not linked to the chemotactic response. And as far as I know, it doesn't chemotaxin response to it either. But it's definitely not linked to the chemotactic response.
The chemotaxin is oxygen, it doesn't have an external oxygen sensor. So it could chemotax basically.
Yeah, oh, that's a good point, yeah.
So it doesn't need an external sensor for chemotaxin. It can just respond
yeah.
to the redox status.
E. coli.
Yeah, it doesn't need
So, okay, so we thought maybe the high-affinity phosphate transporter, FO84, is involved in signaling. And we think not in all. It's just because we can delete this transporter in yeast cells, and one does get a signaling defect. And that signaling defect is either because the cells are indeed starving for phosphate, or because FO84, the transporter, is involved in signaling directly, meaning involved in turning off the signaling pathway in high phosphate. And we think it's not involved in turning off the pathway because anything you do to restore the phosphate uptake defect restores the signaling defect. Introducing proteins that bear no sequence homology to FO84 restore the signaling defect. Okay? So this is an indirect piece of evidence that suggests that, you know, FO84 is not directly involved in signaling, but rather its role is in uptake of phosphate. A perhaps even more compelling experiment comes from a study we did simply characterizing, I guess, feedback in this phosphate-responsive signaling pathway. And what we did is to look at this FO4 green fluorescent protein fusion, its localization within the cell. And here I've shown this is actually a time course of what happens in no phosphate. If you grow cells in high phosphate, transfer them to no phosphate. I told you FO4 goes to the nucleus. And over a time scale of several hours, it simply remains in the nucleus. This isn't very interesting, but what is interesting is that in these intermediate phosphate conditions, what happens when you transfer cells from high phosphate to intermediate phosphate, I've shown you FO4 goes to the nucleus, goes from the cytoplasm to the nucleus, so it accumulates in this partially phosphorylated on site 6. And what we observe is that in the sort of 3 to 6 hour time frame, FO4 is then returns to the cytoplasm. And it remains in the cytoplasm after 6 hours. So if you just keep them in constant levels of this 100 micromolar phosphate, we see FO4 remains in the cytoplasm. So the sort of interpretation of this experiment is that in this case, 100 micromolar phosphate, we have constant external phosphate, but there are changes in signaling going on, reflected in these changes in FO4 localization. And this, of course, implies that the sensor is internal. Okay, so we suspect that phosphate is indeed sensed intracellularly, or some derivative of phosphate. And as I mentioned, we have no idea about the mechanism of the sensing. Okay, so one thing we've studied is where this feedback that I described on the previous slide is coming from. And this type of study has, it turns out, been very fruitful in terms of understanding the dynamics and sort of the system behavior of the FO pathway. So we know two sources of feedback. One of them is regulation of transcription of FO84, this inorganic phosphate transporter. And we can readily measure regulation of FO84 transcription and indeed transcription of any of those phosphate responsive genes. And we typically study the gene FO5 I told you about, as well as FO84. And we do this by making fusions of the promoter regions of these genes to the gene encoding the green fluorescent protein. Okay, so, and then we can monitor expression of the GFP signal in single cells, either microscopically or by fax analysis. And what I'm showing you here is fax. This is a fluorescence activated cell sorter. So we just take cells, and essentially the cells go through the detector one by one by one, and the detector monitors the fluorescence in a single cell. And then what you're seeing here is a histogram where we've monitored many thousands of cells under different phosphate concentrations, and we've looked at GFP expression in a strain carrying the FO5 promoter controlling GFP, and in a different strain where we have the GFP under the control of the FO84 promoter. And the only point I want to make is here with FO84. So what you see is at high phosphate concentrations, you see the a peak representing fluorescence of the cells, and there's, it turns out, little fluorescence in high phosphate. This is because FO84 is turned on, and in no phosphate labeled in blue here, we see a dramatic increase in fluorescence. And there are interesting behaviors we observe here in the two intermediate phosphate concentrations, red and green. You see, well, first, the two promoters behave very differently. I've told you that before, so all the high phosphate, the no phosphate peak for FO5 is very separated from all of the others, and FO84 has a very different pattern. And also you see this interesting behavior with FO84. There are sort of two populations of cells at intermediate phosphate concentrations, some that have turned on FO84 and others that have not. And I'm not going to talk much about that, but the main point is that FO84 transcription is regulated by the FO pathway. Additionally, FO84 endocytosis, so FO84 is internalized from the plasma membrane. That regulation is independent of the FO pathway, but readily visualized. So here we make a protein fusion of FO84 and a special form of GFP whose fluorescence is pH sensitive. When FO84 is internalized in response to phosphate outside the cell, its fluorescence is quenched because it's sent to the vacuole that has a low pH. Okay, and that's what we're measuring here. So we take cells grown in no phosphate, FO84 is localized to the plasma membrane, then we add phosphate outside the cell, and we can monitor either microscopically or by fax analysis the internalization of FO84. So FO84 is regulated in these by these two different mechanisms, and what we think is that these two mechanisms contribute to the feedback in the FO pathway that I told you about before. And this is a wiring diagram that describes what we think is going on. And I can summarize in words: when cells experience a drop in phosphate levels, what we think, well, phosphate uptake, of course, decreases. FO84 transcription, I've shown you, is induced, like in intermediate phosphate or in no phosphate, it's induced. FO84 endocytosis, we know, is decreased, so in response to drop in phosphate levels. And then what happens is phosphate uptake, of course, increases back to acceptable levels. And the converse thing happens when phosphate levels rise. So we think that these two mechanisms, the regulation of endocytosis and the regulation of the transcription of FO84, its abundance, are important mechanisms that allow this system to have the type of feedback I described before. And experimentally, it's easy for us to test the role of these regulation of endocytosis and regulation of transcription experimentally. We can uncouple these two things by placing FO84, for example, under the control of a different promoter. Okay, so we think that because of the two mechanisms of regulation, we think that uptake is stable over many concentrations of external phosphate, and it's made stable by this balance between endocytosis and transcription. Okay. So one potential problem, and this is the last thing I want to touch upon, with this internal sense, the sensitivity derived from an internal sensing mechanism. One potential problem is a problem due to noise. And this, of course, will only be a problem in certain regimes, but it is a potential problem. So if, for example, we imagine internal phosphate levels fluctuating as a function of time, shown in blue, and if the threshold for induction of phosphate-responsive genes, or some of the phosphate-responsive genes, is given by this line, then of course... Okay, so for some of the genes, yeah, so this is a good point. For some of the genes, like FO84, we think the threshold is rather sharp. Genes like FO5, we can't yet measure. We have monitored, for example, ultrasensitivity in the response of like FO4 localization and, as I said, FO84 transcription. And the response is highly ultrasensitive, meaning like apparent Hill coefficient greater than 5. So, you know, it's certainly not formally correct to draw this as a line, but we think there are reasonably defined boundaries. I mean, this is something experimentally we need to probe. I mean, so I mean this only in the most sort of general schematic sense. So anyway, you get the idea that noise may be a problem, and one way to get around the problem is to use some type of low-pass filter or system that buffers that serves as a buffer, basically. And here, the pink line, what I've done is to average simply every 5 time points and draw a line. So you get the idea. So this is one potential problem, and we suspect strongly that, as I mentioned before, that there exists a buffer in this system. Whether it's important for dealing with noise, we have no idea. But I'll tell you something about what we think the buffer, one thing we think the buffer really might be doing. So I've mentioned yeast store polymers of phosphate in the vacuole in the form of polyphosphate, and I've added this onto the wiring diagram here. And so we investigated, you know, what might be the role of polyphosphate in this the faux pathway response that I've been describing. And what we did is to eliminate the buffer and do two experiments. One is to compare the kinetics of activation of the faux genes to the kinetics of activation in a wild type cell. And the second thing we did is to just look at the activation of the faux genes at different phosphate concentrations. So if you have a buffer, you might imagine two things. One is, if the buffer is eliminated, the kinetics of activation might be altered. And second, you know, if noise is a problem, one might imagine that if you eliminate the buffer, that you might get activation of some of the phosphate responsive genes, or even all of the phosphate responsive genes, at a different threshold of phosphate. Okay? And so what we did first here is to monitor the kinetics of activation using this FACS assay of the two genes, FO5 and FO84, and what you see, the first really interesting thing is that the kinetics of activation of FO5 are very different than the kinetics of activation of FO4. So there's a big delay in activation of FO5. If you delete the buffer, so we did this by deleting genes involved in polyphosphate metabolism, you can delete any of them, you get the same result. Now what you see is we eliminate a lot of the kinetic delay in activation of FO5 without affecting the kinetics of activation of FO84. Similarly, in the PHM3 delete cells that can't make what we're calling the putative buffer, the threshold for induction of FO5 is raised. So we see induction of FO5 at a higher phosphate concentration, much higher than in the wild type cell. Okay? So And an additional thing that supports the idea that there's a buffer is, we were talking about this last night, there's another way to cause activation of the pathway that bypasses the whole polyphosphate thing and all the physiology. We can chemically inhibit the activity of this protein kinase less than 5 minutes, and if we monitor the kinetics of induction of FO5 and FO84, they're both induced very rapidly. Okay? So if we bypass use of the buffer, bypass the whole phosphate signal, just directly target the kinase with a chemical and turn on transcription, we get rapid induction of the genes. Okay, so we think polyphosphate might be acting as a buffer. And what we imagine is happening is that internal phosphate levels are, of course, we think, sensed in the cytoplasm, and that there exists this phosphate buffer, a large reservoir of phosphate in the form of polyphosphate in the vacuole. We think the threshold, well, we know experimentally, I'll tell you, the threshold for induction of FO84 is different from the threshold of induction of FO5. So FO84 is induced at a higher phosphate concentration, higher kinase activity than is this gene FO5. Okay, and so what we imagine is happening is when cells experience are transferred, for example, from high phosphate to lower phosphate concentrations, what happens is internal phosphate levels drop, and this is because we presume uptake of phosphate cannot keep up with usage of phosphate by the cell. So internal phosphate levels drop, and they drop, of course, to a point when the buffer is a point. During this drop, the buffer is also mobilized. So I've told you that during this drop in phosphate concentration, FO84 is turned on, and so are genes involved in mobilization of internal phosphate. And so we think during this decrease in putative decrease in internal phosphate levels, the buffer is mobilized, and this essentially prolongs the time before genes like FO5 are induced. And I showed you that experimentally. So here this black dot represents the time at which the internal phosphate levels drop to a point such that FO5 is induced. And now, obviously,
that's much less time than it takes to use up the buffer, right? Do you know the dynamics of the phosphate coming from the buffer, or?
That's not clear. That's an interesting issue. We have not yet measured, and it is hard to measure, mobilization of the buffer. All we can measure is depletion of the buffer. And I will tell you that what I've told you here, depletion of the buffer occurs on a time scale that is the same time scale that we see induction of FO84 and the effects. Induction of FO5. Sorry. Yes, it is depleted on that time. And the time scale of, 1 to 2 hours, it's depleted. Yes. Yes. So they store enough to get through about, 1 to 2 cell cycles. So there's significant depletion. At this point, the buffer's not zero, and I haven't tried to draw it here as zero. Okay, so you can imagine what happens. In the absence of the buffer, obviously, you get the idea. Then FO5 is turned on at much more rapidly than is FO84. And so this is the kind of model we're trying to test and the role for the buffer. So I should stop because I've gone way over and just point out the people who did the work. I've had some fabulous people working on this project, a graduate student, Mike Springer, who's really had a lot of great ideas, and Melissa Thomas, another postdoc who's really executed a lot of critical experiments, and with help from another postdoc, Dennis Wyckoff. So I'm sorry about the long time here.